honor and privilege, as well as great personal joy, to be able to introduce and commend to you Ms. Melanie Delva, who is with us as our keynote address speaker throughout the weekend, as well as somebody who will be serving as somebody. If you have questions about what the journey of reconciliation is looking like across the Anglican Church of Canada, Melanie is a lot of different things, aside from being a fantastic human being and one of the best smilers I know, and one of the loudest laughers in the room. See? She's also currently serving as the animator for reconciliation for the Anglican Church of Canada, which means she is the one who is serving a reflective role. She has been the archivist for, was it the Diocese of New West? And so during all of the TRC proceedings, all of the stuff that was going on around residential schools and claims and stories being told, Melanie spent literally years poring over details of all of those as she made sure that they were kept in good order in a permanent record. In her current job, she'll be able to tell you more about it. My sense of it is that she's providing the opportunity for all of us to hold space and to be actively engaged in the work of reconciliation. What she has to say, in my experience of her, having heard her speak before, is that she is speaking the prophetic. She speaks about God's presence and love in our midst, speaking to the brokenness of our shared past, the past of our colonial heritage, as well as the past of Indigenous peoples in this country. And so she has a lot of really important things to say, and I know that she says them in an honest, but an encouraging and hopeful way. So, without further ado, I introduce to you Melanie Delva.
Good morning. Oh, it's on. Hooray. Good morning. Good morning. I don't think I've ever worn a pop star mic before, so if I suddenly burst into song, I apologize in advance. Nigel, could I get presentation one? Thank you. I would like to begin by acknowledging that the land on which we gather today is Treaty 4 and 6 territory and the traditional lands of the Cree and Salto, Nakota, Lakota, and Dakota peoples, and is the homeland of the Métis people as well. I am profoundly grateful for their continued presence and witness to us who live here. I would also like to respectfully acknowledge any elders who may be in the room, and also any residential school survivors who may be in the room. And because I often don't know who's going to be in the room when I present, I usually start with a bit of a heads up. So I do talk about residential schools and some difficult topics in my presentation, and I acknowledge that for some, this may trigger painful memories, guilt, shame, any other feelings. And I want to acknowledge that that may be the case, and sometimes these things are difficult to hear. So please take care of yourselves, take care of one another, and again, I remind you about the prayer room as well. So my name is Melanie Delva, and I am the Reconciliation Animator for the Anglican Church of Canada. This is a new position, and I began it on June the 1st, so I am new to it as well. And I really want to thank you for having me. I was thrilled to receive the invitation from the bishop. I've decided that they need to start a band called Bishop Del and Dean. I haven't met Del yet, but the three of them gave me this invitation. I think they should start a band. And now that I've seen the guitar, I think it's meant to be. It's really meant to be. So I'm a born and raised rural prairie girl. So to come back to the prairies, the moment that the plane gets over the mountains and I see the checkerboard, I feel like I can breathe. My friends in Vancouver seem to think that mountains are a good thing, but I am so happy to come back to the prairies. So thank you. They didn't give me the remote control, which I think is a great... No, I think it's fantastic, because I think if I hold it, garage doors will start to go up around the neighborhood. I just, me and these kinds of things. So I grew up in a denomination that loved the theology of predestination. They really got excited about it, and I'm still kind of recovering from some of these things. And so I feel that I am predestined to have job titles that nobody understands. and always require explanations. So I thought I'd explain. I spent 12 years as archivist for the Anglican Diocese of New Westminster and the Provincial Synod of BC and Yukon. So I was the Trevor Powell of the Diocese of New Westminster, where I collected, cared for, and made available the historical records of the church there. Now, when you're traveling, particularly in the States, and you're standing before Homeland Security after a long flight, it's important to enunciate, because if they think you said anarchist instead of archivist, you spend a long time in a windowless room in Homeland Security. Not that I know anything about this. I'll never travel to Detroit ever again. I think I have PTSD from that experience. So believe it or not, this is actually a photo of Trevor Powell. I know he's not here to defend himself, so I can make fun of him. I actually have a great deal of respect for Trevor. He's one of my archival heroes. And so this is Trevor with his mask on there. Now I am an animator. For the record, I don't work for Disney. I get asked a lot if I illustrate things, and if I were to illustrate things, reconciliation would go absolutely nowhere. So an animator, or an animateur in French, is someone who leads and encourages participation in a particular activity, and especially a cultural activity. So my role has four kind of facets to it. The first is to create and encourage a reconciliation network, team, initiatives across the Canadian church. So there is a lot of activity already happening in the church at parish levels, at deanery levels, at diocesan levels, and my job is to encourage that network, to set it up and get people connected. It's also my role to monitor the ongoing responses of the church to the 94 calls to action that were the result, or one of the results, of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And in your swag bags, which you received yesterday, you'll see a little booklet which actually has all 94 calls in it, as well as the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So I encourage you to keep that handy, as we'll be talking more about those later. Third, ongoing responses to calls for justice and solidarity from Indigenous communities. So this is when local Indigenous communities particularly ask us to stand in solidarity, be it a resource extraction or murdered and missing Indigenous women, when we are asked to stand with be in solidarity with Indigenous communities. Those kinds of requests would come to me. I wouldn't necessarily make the decisions about them, but I would be the point person for them. And finally, what I'm doing here today is part of my role, creating educational opportunities, speaking, allowing space, as the dean said, for the church to engage on subjects pertaining to the historical and ongoing effects of colonization. Thank you. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about me, because this is going to, I think that having a sense of who the person is sometimes helps to understand where the person is coming from. So I'm a first-generation Canadian of Belgian descent. I was born in the elevator of Brandon General Hospital. My mom never made it to the delivery room with any of her kids. It just so happened that I was born in the elevator. Poor planning on her part, I think, but what do I know? I don't have kids. I grew up on Treaty 4 territory in Manitoba, very rural, near a large Métis settlement, and next to the Tutnawazabeg First Nation. The context of my upbringing was profoundly racist. I put a photo of me on my little tricycle there. I think I'm 4 years old there. And I put that up there because that's the approximate age I was when I first heard conversations about dirty Indians. So that's what I grew up in. From a very small age, I was surrounded by a profoundly racist context. I also have some photos of my adoptive family. I was spiritually adopted into the Grizzly Clan of the Litton Band of the Inklakatma First Nation, which is in British Columbia. And this was after my 10 years working with residential school survivors from the area as they walked through the truth and reconciliation process. So I also bring you greetings today from my Papa Coyote, who's in the bottom photo there, the small one. My father Coyote, Terry Alec, was the first Indian residential school survivor in Canada to file suit against the government of Canada. And I also bring greetings from his wife, White Wolf Woman, and my sisters, Rainey and Echo. As I said, for 12 years I was archivist in the Anglican Church. When most of the residential schools closed in Canada, the records went to the National Archives in Ottawa. But in the case of St. George's Lytton, which is in the Fraser Canyon of British Columbia, when the school closed, the records were left behind and ended up in our archives. As far as I am aware, we were the only religious archives in Canada with a full set of student records of students at St. George's School. So for 12 years, I helped survivors prove their attendance at St. George's for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And with only a few exceptions, every one of those hundreds of survivors told me at least part of, if not most, of their story of residential schools. And many of them talked about being incarcerated in the schools, not attending. And it was devastating for me. In the book Yours, Mine, and Ours, Chris Hiller writes about listening to Indigenous peoples in order to be undone by the other, undone by hard truths. I was undone by the records, and particularly a young boy named Michael. In the early 20th century, so 1910, 1911, an epidemic swept through St. George's Lytton. And Michael was a young boy of 7. And as I was going through the records of St. George's, preparing them for the TRC, I came across a file of correspondence. And the correspondence was between the principal of the school at the time, the local Indian agent, who was the government agent who was monitoring that area, and the parents of Michael. And Michael's parents wrote to the Indian agent and the principal because they had learned that their son Michael had become ill in the epidemic, and they realized he was going to die. And so they wrote to the principal and the Indian agent asking him that he be sent home so that he could die at home. And so this file of correspondence that I was holding in my hands was correspondence between the Indian agent and the principal going back and forth, deciding whether or not they were going to send Michael home. And in the end, they denied that request. So Michael died in the school and was buried in an unmarked grave on the playground. And the file goes on to tell of his parents writing to the Indian agent asking if Michael's body could be exhumed and sent home for a traditional burial in the Fraser Canyon. And again, the principal and the Indian agent go back and forth. And in the end, they decided that if this family wanted the body of their 7-year-old son, they would have to pay for the exhumation and transport costs for him to go home. And they could not afford those costs. This was the point at which I broke. The result of bearing witness to what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission called cultural genocide, but which many others, including myself, call genocide. I have seen and heard and read things that can never be unseen, unheard, or unread. No one can ever convince me that it wasn't that bad. Healing for me, and only God's grace could be involved in a twist in the story like this, healing for me came through the survivors. They were the only ones who could understand what I was witnessing because they were the ones who had experienced it directly. They held me, they prayed with me, they smudged me, they visited me in the hospital, they laughed with me, and they sat with me. I had a lot of guilt and shame to work through. Guilt that this country I so loved and thought was so great had done this. Guilt that the church I had converted into as an adult and was so proud of could have been partners in this. And of course, guilt about my own racist upbringing and some of the beliefs that I still held. This was a process of transformation and redemption for me through God's grace alone. Only in a world marked with God's fingerprints could a residential school survivor who previously could not be in a room with a white person and a white person who was recovering from a racist family upbringing, only in God's world could we become a family. A lot of my transformative process has also been in becoming more educated about how we ended up where we are. So I thought I would give you a very quick Coles Notes overview of a couple of the factual pieces that helped me understand the hows and whys of the landscape of Indigenous and settler peoples' relationships in Canada. The doctrine of discovery, sometimes called the doctrine of Christian discovery, is a set of beliefs and legal framework born out of a series of edicts issued by the Pope in the 15th century. Now, I'm not good at math, but that means the 1400s. The edicts known as papal bulls asserted that lands not inhabited by Christians were empty, unowned, and available to be discovered and claimed and owned. The term terra nullius literally means nobody's land or empty land, and was applied to all of North America. In applying the doctrine of discovery to what is now known as North America, colonial powers were able to take over and profit from the lands that had been inhabited for centuries by Indigenous peoples from time immemorial. It enabled them to accumulate massive wealth by engaging in unlimited resource extraction and settlement on the lands. Further, the use of this doctrine was the basis for dehumanizing Indigenous peoples. If the land is empty, but there are inhabitants, those inhabitants cannot be seen as human. They're considered inhuman. The doctrine was used to gauge humanity. If there were no Christians on the land was empty. There were no humans. And the denial of the essential humanity of Indigenous peoples laid the groundwork for many ways that racism and injustice manifests even today in the history of North America. We see it in the residential school system. We see it in the Indian Act. We see it in the history of the illegalization of Indigenous language and spiritual practice. We can still see it at work today. Resource extraction on lands of Indigenous people without free, prior, and informed consent. Discrimination, as seen in the overrepresentation of Indigenous peoples in the child welfare system and the justice system. And the denial of the right of Indigenous people to self-determination and control of their own governments and traditional systems of governance and spiritual practices. The Indian Act was something that I had heard of. Oh, one back, two back. Oh, more back. There we go. Spoiler alert. The Indian Act was something that I had heard of but not really understood. The Indian Act denied women status who married non-Indigenous men. And this wasn't until 1985. This is well within our lifespans. It introduced the pass system, which meant that Indigenous peoples could not leave reserves without permission, written permission, from an Indian agent. And this pass system lasted until 1951. It also meant that any Indigenous person under the Act who went to university was enfranchised. Which sounds great, except that enfranchisement actually means that they lost status if they went to university. It forbade Indigenous political organizations. It forbade raising of funds for legal claims. Indigenous people couldn't hire a lawyer. It imposed a banned council system, which is still in place today, but is not a traditional Indigenous governance system. It declared the potlatch and other spiritual tradition practices illegal and denied Indigenous people the right to vote. The Indian Act is not a historical thing. It's still alive and well today, still controlling the lives of Indigenous peoples in Canada. And then there's the residential school system. At various times between 1820 and 1969, the Anglican Church of Canada administered about 30 Indian and Eskimo residential schools and hostels, as they were called. At its peak involvement in the 1920s, the church concurrently operated 24 schools, situated mostly in northern regions, but not all. Some of these residential schools replaced or supplemented mission day schools, Others were established in new areas, replacing earlier boarding schools. And many were built by the government to be run by the Anglican Church. You may know that Gordon School operated in this diocese for 110 years and was actually the last residential school in Canada to close in 1996. That means that I could have done my entire education at an Indian residential school were I Indigenous. Students were sent from local nations, but were also sent to Gordon's from as far away as Alberta, northern Manitoba, northwestern Ontario, and even the Northwest Territories and other Arctic settlements. Children who were sent to Gordon's from far away often didn't see their parents for years at a time because the distance was too far to go home for holidays. The Anglican Church only officially ran the school until 1969, but still provided chaplaincy services to the school until 1991. In addition to loss of language, familial connections, and culture, students experienced physical and sexual abuse at the school. I know the history of many of the Anglican residential schools in Canada. They were all bad, but Gordon's was very bad. I tell you these things not to induce shame or guilt. I know some of you may already know these things and others may not, but in order to move towards reconciliation, we need to know where we have come from, the history of the harm. While it's critical to tell the truth about what happened, getting mired in shame and guilt can be just another way of avoiding action, and we'll talk about that a bit later. So I don't tell you this to make you feel bad. The good news is that the Anglican Church has been very involved and active in reconciliation. I don't know if people in the back can see this, so I'll go through these. In 1993, Primate Michael Pearce, who of course has a history in this diocese, one of my heroes, offered an apology for the residential school harms. In 2001, a new Agape resource on reconciliation was published and is still used to this day. In 2006, the residential school settlement agreement was signed, putting an end to the largest class action lawsuit in Canadian history. In 2010, the General Synod endorsed the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And in 2010, the General Synod also repudiated, so says is invalid, will not recognize any longer the doctrine of discovery after almost 600 years. In 2012 and 2013, Canon 22 on the formalization of a parallel Indigenous governance structure, a national Indigenous bishop, a sacred circle of Indigenous decision-making, and the Anglican Council of Indigenous Peoples is recognized officially. And in 2014, the Primate's Commission on Discovery, Reconciliation, and Justice is formed and commissioned to hold the Church accountable on its call to repudiate the doctrine of discovery and take seriously the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. In 2017, a full-time animator for reconciliation is commissioned, and also the Road to Warm Springs is called. This was a consultation just in September on Indigenous Anglican self-determination, and that convened in Pinawa, Manitoba. We've come a long way in the last few decades, and we have a ways to go, but there is much to celebrate. There's great news. Many are on the journey together. I put a call out to all the bishops and all of the Indigenous and non-Indigenous leaders in the Anglican Church of Canada, asking what was happening in their diocese for regarding reconciliation. And I thought, well, I'll probably get two or three emails back, and I was swamped with emails coming back, which was so encouraging of what people on the ground are doing in terms of reconciliation. Many are on this journey together. We are not alone in our desire to see reconciliation manifest and grow. And believe it or not, the good news is that we'll also make mistakes and survive them. I know this from a lot of experience. I'm fantastic at making mistakes. This is one of my spiritual gifts. It's not mentioned in the Bible. Pretty sure that somebody just overlooked it. But we will survive the mistakes we make. And in fact, in my experience, the mistakes And the reconciliation that comes after making mistakes makes us stronger in our bonds. It's a beautiful thing. Another piece of good news is that God is on our side. Now, I know in a lot of wartime, everybody thinks that God is on our side, but God really is on our side on this one. And we know this because God is a reconciling God. All this is from God, who through Christ reconciles us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, in Christ, God was reconciled to the world and to himself. I'd like to end this part of my presentation with a prayer, and then I'll invite questions or comments. So would you pray with me? Most merciful God, we have erred in our treatment of each other. We have not always been good relatives. We have not always honored each other and who we are as your creation, and we have wrongly judged on your behalf. Restore the treasures of our cultures. Open our hearts to feel your heartbeat in the drum, and let your heartbeat echo upon Mother Earth, calling us to right relationship. We give honor to you, O God, our Creator, your Son, the Peacemaker, and the Sacred Spirit. Amen. If there are any questions, I invite them now. There's a microphone here. And if not, we can have an awkward silence, which I'm also fine with, or we can move on. So if there are any questions, I'd invite them now. I'm totally fine with awkward silences. Most of my life is profoundly awkward.
Thanks, Melanie, for your excellent presentation and passion for this work. I would like to know how other dioceses are moving in the direction of incorporating the truth and reconciliation process into their structure. Is there a standing committee on truth and reconciliation in some places? And are there... There was another point I wanted to make, and that was gone. So, you want to answer that question?
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. Thank you for that excellent question. Yeah, and I'll be talking a little bit more in the following presentations. I should have said there's kind of a trajectory to them, and I'll talk a bit more about that. But there's several great examples. The Diocese of Edmonton has a Standing Stones ministry, which involves urban Indigenous ministry as well as rural. There are other dioceses that have committees on an elders and youth circle. There are some that have kind of a parallel Indigenous leadership, kind of a more of a traditional circle decision-making body. Some have funded Indigenous missioners in their dioceses. So there's a lot of activity. I'll give some more concrete examples in one of my other presentations. But there's a lot that we can look to, and other in other denominations as well. Ecumenically, there's a lot happening as well. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And will you be talking about the government putting together a Truth and Reconciliation Day of the Year? Has that happened yet?
That's a great question. I sit on what's called the All Parties table. And so when the TRC was formed and the settlement agreement was signed, all of the parties to the settlement, so that's all of the churches that ran residential schools, as well as the Government of Canada, came together in what was called the All Parties. And that's where we discuss the commitments that we each have and what's happening. And so one of the great things about sitting at that table is that the church parties can pressure the government about their calls to action, and the government can pressure the churches. Not pressure, well, part of it's pressure and part of it is encouragement. To my knowledge, the national day, which is called, I can't remember what call it is, but it's one of the calls that there should be a day that recognizes and remembers
Aboriginal Awareness Day.
So there is a National Aboriginal Day, but there's, I think the call, I can't remember what number it is, but it is supposed to honor the residential school survivors and victims. And that hasn't happened yet, but is one of the things that we continue to ask government representatives at the table. Yeah. Anyone else? Someone is either getting more coffee or come up to the mic if you'd like to speak. Yeah.
Oops. I'm Barb Cameron from St. Matthew's Church. My question is, I loved your presentation, and thank you so much, and I'm so supportive of the work that you're doing. I think it's incredible that you're talking to a group like this. But my question is, how much do you ever talk about the intention that was at the time when the residential schools were set up? I'm sure the government had good intentions when they did this. They felt they were doing the best they could to help the Aboriginal, for the Indigenous people to be assimilated, which they felt would be good for them. I don't think they intended it to land up the way that it did. And is there any recognition historically of why these schools were set up? That's just a thought I've always had.
Yeah, thank you. They actually did intend for the system to destroy Indigenous culture. We've seen that in the correspondence that's in the government archives as well as in the church archives. The stated intention was to destroy Indian communities and culture. And assimilation was seen to be a good thing, certainly. And one thing that I do talk about is the system was evil. Not everyone in the system was evil. So there were people who did have good intentions entirely, but the system itself was one that wanted to destroy a culture and a people, most certainly. Yeah.
Rosa? Oh, yes, clergy next.
I wasn't butting in line. Thank you very much for your presentation, Melanie. I really appreciate that we have somebody in your role who comes from an area and a community that has struggled with racism. I myself am a priest in charge in a rural community. I grew up in that community. I'm familiar with the kind of attitudes, the diversity of attitudes amongst the people there. And I'm curious to hear about your thoughts on from yourself and your experience of knowing and loving people who have a wide variety of views, likely, how can we, in those, as ministers in those places, foster a greater awareness and a greater empathy and compassion? And partly as a part of that, what are some resources for parishes that want to increase those things amongst our congregants?
It's a great question. Thank you very much. I know that for me, part of my inherent racism was not knowing a lot. I didn't know what the Indian Act was. I didn't know that the government stated that they wanted to kill the Indian and the child, keep the child alive, but kill the Indian. And so there, part of it was an educational process for me to really understand. Our country has raised us in school systems that teach us certain things about the way our country was set up. So part of it is, for me, an educational thing. But you're right, I am from a family that still believes what it believes. And part of it is love. Listening, challenging when I can, knowing when arguing really isn't the thing. But relationship is really what turned things around for me. So part of the problem with my upbringing is I had all these ideas, I had all these notions, but I had never really been in relationship with an Indigenous person. So when I go into non-Indigenous communities, settler communities, I often say, start with a relationship. Who can you build a relationship with? How can we bring Indigenous and non-Indigenous communities together in a way that's safe for both parties, where each party can listen to one another? And in terms of resources, I'll have some in other presentations, and also one of the tasks that I'm working on is a resource kit for parishes. So here are some educational resources, here are some ways that you can start to think about building bridges and building community and building relationship. But for me, that relationship was a real turnaround. I hope that at least partly answers it.
So we're still waiting for the resource kit.
You are still waiting for the resource kit.
No worries.
I promise it's coming. I'll get to it. Yeah, and part of it is kind of one-pagers on, you know, a trifold brochure, just something that people can pick up on the doctrine of discovery. I mean, When I started reading about the doctrine of discovery, I had to read like academic papers on this, and the average person doesn't have time or doesn't really want to. So educating people in one-pagers about it, and then a new Agape, which is actually online, which is the 2001 resource, even though it's, you know, a good 15, 16 years old, it's actually quite good, and it's online in its entirety at anglican.ca. So until the toolkit is ready, that's certainly one place to start. Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm short. I need this slower. My name's Rosa. I'm from, I don't know, this is, I'm from Columba, but I'm from Fort Capel. My question is, were you talking about, like, Orange Shirt Day?
Yes.
On September 30th, it's Orange Shirt Day to remember all the survivors and people who didn't survive of residential schools. And is there a church level to that? Like, is there a church thing for it, too?
That's such a great question. So for those of you who don't know, Orange Shirt Day is whatever day of the week is closest to September 30th. This year it was on a Friday, when many of us wear orange shirts to remember residential school survivors and those who didn't survive, as Rosa told us. And the story is an Indigenous girl was sent to residential school, and she was wearing an orange shirt that had been given to her as a gift. And the shirt was removed from her and taken away, and she was given a uniform, and she remembers that shirt. And so we wear orange shirts. To this, at this time, I don't think that there is an official church component to the Orange Shirt Day, but I do know that many churches and many dioceses have kind of picked it up as something that they do.
Yeah, because I know, like, my school does it. Like,
yeah.
The, most of the school division does it as a thing, because one of my teachers started it off.
Wow, so, thank you.
And we also do the blanket exercise, which is something different.
Yeah, thank you, Rosa. That's fantastic.
My name's Brian Woods, and I am the incumbent at All Saints Weyburn. We have a very good resource within our diocese. If you want to, they come from Fort Capel. We just had a blanket exercise in Weyburn, and it's led by Indigenous students. Well, the ones that we had were former Indigenous students. And the remark that was made, because we did our blanket exercise and then we had talking circle right afterwards.
Oh, wow.
And I think what a lot of us would be, what was very meaningful to me was what one of the young men said. When the white settlers came to Canada, they thought they brought God to us. What they didn't realize was God was already here.
Amen.
And I think we forget that at times, that God was already here, and we thought we brought God to the savage, the native, you know, as they were called.
Yeah.
And so we just need to remember that God was already here. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And I do commend the blanket exercise to you. It's quite an amazing experience.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
My name is Vera Ash, and actually, I live right by that, where the school was. My parents were residential school survivors, I guess as you call them. And actually, I guess it started with my dad when he was about six or seven. He was taken from his home, sent to Elkhorn, Manitoba.
Yeah.
And then my mom was put in Gordon Residential School. Well, today I look after my mom. She's 96, but she has a grade 5 education because at the school, they had to work half the day, go to school half the day. But as it turned out, she worked there for 28 years in the kitchen. You know. And she was quite interested in helping kids to get through school and did her best, you know, to be there for them. And actually, I guess, like, it was quite an effect on the rest of us, even us as kids, because as youngsters, my grandparents, all they talked was Cree. Mm. My dad and his family did, but with us, they never talked Cree. So as a result, us kids lost our language because he got in trouble in school for talking Cree, so he wouldn't let us talk Cree. And then when I started working for the government, like I worked for the government for 34 years, and when I first started, I didn't realize the effect of residential school was on me because I could not speak up, you know, to, like, I'm surprised I'm standing here doing this now because I could never speak up. In the office, like, I used to work with more non-First Nation people, and they could holler across the room at each other. I could not do that. I had to go up to the person. Because, see, my dad also told us, after, when we're going to school, just mind your own business. Don't say anything. Like, don't speak up. And, you know, I think a lot of that had a detrimental effect on a lot of First Nation people. Because even after workshops I took at work about First Nation speaking, you know, speaking up, and like we were not, our culture was not to look you in the eye when we spoke to you. And apparently that was against us because it was like we were just, like they said, dumb Indians looking down all the time. But I guess that was, we didn't realize at the time that was a part of our culture. And now things are changing. And it's nice to, it's like it's something to hear about this reconciliation. And I think a lot of people are understanding, you know, like, sure, they're apologizing. There's some people that are not recognizing it, but it's a case of life goes on. And like I said, I went to that school right from the time I started till I finished. And really, it, this residential school thing did set us back, you know, many years. And like right now, they say, okay, move ahead, forget about it. But some people, it was really, really affected them. And then it carried on to their family. So it's, there's always reminders, you know. And I think that school, like I said, I went there the whole time. I loved it, you know. And there was, like, I had no, there was no, nothing to me because I was just day school. That was another reason my parents wouldn't let us go to residential school because they were both there. So, and then they always, like, Mom always took us to church. Like, Anglican Church, St. Luke's was our church. And you know, sometimes for me, it's hard to kind of think about the residential school thing and the Anglican Church and everything else, you know. But it, I guess it was all a part of life. But as far as I'm concerned, it was really a holdback for First Nations people. You know, and like right now, a lot of my understanding or my feeling is a lot of First Nation people think, oh, and all that, so you're just blaming that, you know. But really, like I said, even for myself, not being able to speak up and to look back on it now, it was a bad thing for me in my life because I could really could never move forward, you know, until finally I did move on, then I got married, and as I went on in my workplace, I started to speak up because I took workshops where it's, you know, we're all unique. We have our own personalities. So I started speaking up, and then one time my husband told me, he said, you know, he said, too bad you weren't like you were before you learned that. Anyway, this was an interesting presentation. Mm-hmm. And to me, it is good for non-First Nation people to actually, you know, you hear this, you hear that, but there is some people that actually, you know, like the reason I am speaking up now is to say that it had an effect even on me, you know, and like I thought I got an education in school and everything, but to look back on it now, like this not speaking up, not being able to get involved was all a part of my teachings from my parents because of the trouble they got into that don't speak your, like I can't speak my language now. And because, you know, they wouldn't speak Cree to us. But all in all, I just want to let you know that there was an effect even for me. And like I said, my mom is 96 years old. She moved forward. She didn't let anything bother her. And like I said, she was a very church woman. So to me, God helped her move forward, you know. And she brought that to us. And so with that, I thank you all. And it was a good presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vera. And if ever you get the joy of going to St. Luke's Gordon's, Vera's mum did all the beadwork on the altar frontal. It is a sight to be seen. Thank you, Graham.
Yeah, there is a term called intergenerational survivors. And these are the children and grandchildren of residential school survivors. And sometimes survivors didn't know how to parent or passed on some of the teachings that they had learned in residential school to children. So it's very much a fact. Thank you, Vera. Hi.
Hi, I'm Graham Henneberg from St. Paul's Regina.
Hi, Graham.
And I was just wondering, are there any ways to access the actual records from the schools?
Mm-hmm. Well,
yes, there are databases.
Yeah, so there's all of the records from all of the churches and from the federal government went to what's called the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation in Winnipeg. And I can talk to you later, but it's nctr.ca. Now, not all of the records have been digitized and put online yet, but many of them have. And so you can actually read the correspondence of the principals, of the government, of the Indian agents. You can see photographs, you can see plans, all of these kinds of things online. Yeah, it's there, and more will go online as they digitize. But I can give you the address after if you'd like.
All right, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Melanie, I forgot to tell you my name, Trish McCarthy.
I'm from
Saskatchewan Gateway. And I would just like to ask you a question about language and whether the Anglican Church is contributing specifically to language projects, preservation of First Nation languages.
Absolutely.
In Canada.
Absolutely. Great question. So the Anglican Healing Fund has given tens of thousands of dollars towards language reclamation and translation projects. And the great thing about the Anglican Healing Fund is that it's all of the projects have to be community-based and Indigenous-led. So, and they don't have to have any association with the Anglican Church in order to be funded. And actually, this is a good plug for the Healing Fund because this year that's the focus of Giving with Grace. And so the Anglican Healing Fund, which actually predated the apology, has been depleted over its 20 or 25 year history. And so there is a campaign right now to top up the Anglican Healing Fund so that we can continue to give those kinds of grants. That's one of the places where it happens. And also the Anglican Foundation also gives grants towards language reclamation and language classes and teaching.
I can speak to the fact that two grants have been allowed here. So one, Treaty 4 for Fort Qu'Appelle area. A recent grant was given for language studies in that area. And there's another one developing in Kwakatoos First Nation. So we're hopeful that we might get another grant given for language studies there for children.
Mike Sinclair, St. Paul's, Regina. Sorry, I'm actually asking a question.
Oh, I thought you were like pulling the plug.
I'm not cutting you off.
Time to get off.
And on the plane. Just in the last number of weeks, as I know that you're aware, there have been some rulings around record keeping to do with the records of the TRC and of residential school survivors. And if anybody's not familiar with those rulings, is that different aspects of the government have now said those records don't have to be kept. They can just be destroyed. And now part of me wants to be outraged by that. Part of me is outraged by that. And I recognize at the same time that's a rather privileged outrage because those are not my stories. Mm. Could you speak to that a little bit, just in terms of not only the work that you're doing now, but the work that you did before?
Yeah. So the one thing that's important to keep in mind with that particular ruling is that it's a very specific record set. So some people think it's all the residential school records that are being destroyed. That's not the case. There was a specific process where students who experienced severe abuse sexually or physically could go through a special process as part of the TRC called the independent assessment process. And that in that process, they would give their testimony, not testimony, that's totally a different thing. They would give they would testify to what had happened to them. And so those records are a very specific record set about those independent assessments. And the ruling was because they're very detailed, they name perpetrators, they name other students who may have also been abused in the schools, and so there's a lot of personal information in them. I am also of 2, 3, 4, 14 minds about it. As an archivist, I'm horrified when any record is destroyed. I just lie awake in hives about it. It really kind of gets to me. The other thing is, the good news about those is twofold in my own mind. The first part is that the survivors gave those testimonies under the impression that the records would not be kept. So when they gave it, they were promised that this would never be public. And so to keep them and to someday perhaps make them public under another government would be to go against what the survivors gave this testimony believing would be the case. The other part is that any survivor who would like to opt in can decide that they want theirs kept. So there's a 15-year period before the testimonials are destroyed. And in that 15-year period, a survivor can write in, or probably a set of government forms, where they can fill out this form and their particular assessment will be kept. So those are the things that kind of give me some comfort about it. And in the end, like you, I think, who am I to decide? Part of what makes me uncomfortable is that I believe survivors should always have the decision. And so part of me is glad that there is this opt-in. I worry about survivors who have already died in this process or who may not know about the process and may not have the chance to have their voice heard.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. So maybe I'll wrap it up there for now. There'll be more presentations to come. Stay tuned. And hopefully we can have more of a conversation. And I'll be around for the whole synod. Lucky you. So thank you very much for your kind attention and for your questions and commentary. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.